news about some compelling reading is spreading by word of mouth. The mouth in question belongs to Tina Brown. She's editor of a website called The Daily Beast, and she's also the former editor of magazines like Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. She's an omnivorous reader of articles and stories from all over, so this summer we've been asking what she's reading. The last time we spoke, you had sent us an article about writers who drink, who abuse substances, and I asked you if, as an editor, you preferred to work with people like that. You actually said yes, and now you've sent us an article about Annie Leibovitz, the famous photographer who used to work for you.
Indeed, yes. This current New York magazine has a big piece about Annie's big financial problems that she's in at the moment. Annie's $24 million in debt, which is pretty extraordinary when you consider it. But, you know, of course, I'm a great fan of Annie's. You know, working with her as I did at Vanity Fair, a lot of her problems really stem from her extraordinary perfectionism. This is a person who just wants to only focus on her work, to drill down to the very best picture. And she really will do anything it takes, whether it means flying people around the country or going into overtime or, you know, bringing people to the set or redoing the set or redoing the whole thing three times. She just doesn't really care, as long as she gets her picture. And, of course, that has often led her into a huge overtime and a great deal of financial issues, which we're now seeing coming to roost.
Although we should emphasize, she was spending your money when she did that.
Well, you know, I mean, I used to have to get a grip on her, and it was hard.
Sounds like from this article, the descriptions given in this New York Magazine article, that in her earlier life, Annie Leibovitz was relatively modest in her personal spending, her personal circumstances, except for a drug habit, but lived in a modest apartment, and that changed in recent years, which is part of her trouble now.
It did, and I think it was all part of the kind of borrowing on the never, never madness that everybody got into. I mean, Annie's a zeitgeist creature herself, and in a way, everything that's happened to her reflects the zeitgeist in which she's lived. I mean, she moved in a world of celebrities. She became the lover of Susan Sontag, the famous critic. She mixed with movie stars and rock stars and so forth. And after a time, that lifestyle starts to rub off. But I will say that I don't fear for Annie in the long run. She's a superb talent, and she's not really a person. She's not a Michael Jackson figure who wants to go off and live the life of craziness. She actually is a woman of simple taste. It's just that things got out of hand.
Buying two townhouses in Greenwich Village, spending millions of dollars renovating, and then having a terrible construction accident that added even more to that. Yeah, that's
indeed
out of hand. And some other trouble as well. I mean, lots of expenses to deal with.
Yeah, she did. She really did get out of hand. And, you know, unfortunately, she felt it would go on forever, the big ad contracts and the big American Express deals. And, of course, now the economy collapsed and a lot of those big deals are not there anymore.
This is maybe my favorite detail in the whole thing, that American Express wanted her at one point to endorse their card, and her credit had actually been so bad over the years they'd denied her the card.
That sounds like our Annie, absolutely.
So we have this person who is an obsessive perfectionist when it comes to photography, and then you send me this other article on your reading list, which is also about a different kind of obsessive personality, an article in The New Yorker from a couple of years ago about Asperger's syndrome.
Which has just become a new book, actually, called Parallel Play by Tim Page. It speaks very much to my heart because I have an Asperger's boy myself, George, who is now 23, 24. So I know what it's like to raise an Asperger's child. And this piece, which describes the isolation and the lack of kind of social ability to read clues and so forth, really spoke to what I have dealt with in my son, who is both so adorable in so many ways and yet in other ways just cannot really at times read the room in ways that anyone can who is raised, you know, without this affliction. For instance, my son might once said to somebody, "You could use a facelift."
Could they have used a facelift?
It was all true. And, you know, one of the things that was funny about it is how do you explain to somebody, you know, you're speaking the truth, but you can't speak the truth, darling. So I found this piece and this book now by Paige, you know, an extraordinarily moving account, really, from the inside of what it is like to feel pretty isolated, really, at times from the world and from the signals that it gives each other. It's not easy being these kids.
You have also sent us an article by the conservative writer Peggy Noonan, who seems to be obsessing about politics.
Yes, Peggy Noonan is one of my favorite conservative writers, actually. Peggy's a really good and thoughtful writer, and she's not a kind of unfair writer either. She has a point of view, but she's very wise. And she's concerned about Obama. She says, you know, he never seems to be leveling these days, only talking. And she kind of feels that this healthcare thing has gone wildly off track for him. She says that, you know, in a way, it's done something that no one could have expected. It's actually united the Republican Party because he hasn't had a clear vision. He hasn't had a clear point of view that he's been able to sell, instead of which he's overwhelmed everybody with too much at once. Actually, we had a good piece as well on the Daily Beast by Connors Friedendorf, which did also take issue with this and said, don't try to do everything at once.
In addition to some of the periodicals that you've sent us and you've been sending us, you've sent along a novel this time, or recommended a novel, Let the Great World Spin.
By Colm McCann, the brilliant, brilliant young Irish writer who's actually teaches English now at Hunter College in New York. This is an absolutely fascinating sort of poetic but gritty account of life in New York during the 70s. And it has a wonderful binding motif, which is the high wire walk of Pettit, who I think there was a movie made out of his antics where he walked between the two towers of the World Trade Center. There are four or five stories in this book, but they're all bound together by that summer day where they looked up and saw Pettit walking on that high wire as a kind of moment of a sort of still point in a turning world. Because that time of the 70s was a time of roughness and terrible recession in New York. New York was bankrupt. It was grimy. And so you have the stories of a young Irish priest working in the projects. You have the story of a hooker that he administers to from her point of view. You have the story of a wife who finds that her son has died in Vietnam. And you have the story of the nurse that the Irish priest was in love with. And they're all linked together. It's a bit like the movie Crash, but done from the point of view of New York in the 70s. I absolutely found it gripping.
Does it feel resonant in this time, given the economic situation in New York?
I mean, I have to say that it does feel a little bit as if we're heading that direction. When I read the story of Annie Leibovitz's excess and bankruptcy, and it feels like everywhere you turn, there is a story about somebody going broke.
Tina Brown, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Word of mouth from Tina Brown, editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast. And when you check the news headlines throughout the day at npr.org, you can also find links to the articles that Tina Brown discussed. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee Montaigne is in our studios tomorrow. I'm Steve Inske.
One of the most influential figures in TV news has died. Don Hewitt was the creative force behind 60 Minutes on CBS News, the show's executive producer. Hewitt died this morning from pancreatic cancer at his home in Bridgehampton, New York. He was 86. NPR's David Folkenflik has the story.
With Pavlovian predictability, millions of Americans have tuned for decades to watch 60 Minutes, whether to see the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran questioned by Mike Wallace.
And he calls you, Imam, forgive me, his words not mine, a lunatic.
Or Steve Croft grilling the Clintons about their marriage at a pivotal moment in the 1992 presidential race.
You know, I'm not sitting here as some little woman standing by my man like Tammy Wynette.
There were exposés, interviews with cultural stars. Hewitt created a television news magazine that reflected his own nature.
Brash, noisy. Don was right out of the front page. I mean, he was a character.
60 Minutes correspondent Morley Safer worked with Hewitt from 1970 until Hewitt's retirement in 2004.
For every 1,000 crazy ideas he had 10 brilliant ones. The great thing about Don was you could talk him out of the crazy ones. You could never talk him out of the brilliant ones.
Hewitt was a college dropout who served in the Merchant Marine and covered World War II as a reporter before joining CBS News in 1948. That year, Hewitt directed the first American television newscast and went on to work with Edward R. Murrow. Hewitt also produced the seminal televised Kennedy-Nixon debates of 1960, and he was the first executive producer of Walter Cronkite's half-hour CBS Evening News. Hewitt helped introduce the teleprompter, on-air captions, and the template for television coverage of political conventions. He once described his brightest idea of all to CBS's Harry Smith.
We were doing documentaries, CBS reports, NBC white paper, ABC close-up. They were all too fussy and too important and too self-important. And I said, you got to do what Life magazine does. You got to put a cover with it. You got to put personality. Nobody was interested in the voice of the corporation. They wanted to hear the voice of real people.
It became 60 Minutes. There were missteps, too. Hewitt held back key elements of a story about the whistleblower from the tobacco industry after the threat of litigation, a controversial decision he later regretted. Yet, at the 60 Minutes offices today in Manhattan, there was only fondness. Hewitt's successor, Jeff Fager, reached out to the lions of the show, including Andy Rooney.
Hi, Andy. I know. It's tough. I talked to Marilyn and to Billy.
Fager says Hewitt's brashness often obscured his deftness as an editor who improved just about everything he touched, including one of Fager's first pieces for 60 Minutes.
This was a story about Poland right after the wall came down and trying capitalism. It wasn't very good. I wasn't sure how he would react, but the lights came on after the screening and he said, "Where do you want a kid? Right between the eyes?"
4 decades after its creation, 60 Minutes remains the most watched news show on television, a tribute not only to its famous correspondents, but the profane television wizard who paced in the control room for so many years. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Don Hewitt, the veteran TV producer-director who created the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes, died this week at the age of 86. In a few minutes, we'll listen to Terry's 2001 interview with Hewitt. But first, our TV critic David Biancooley, who considers Hewitt one of the seminal figures in the history of television news.
Don Hewitt didn't invent the TV news magazine, but he sure invented the most successful and durable one. He created 60 Minutes in 1968, 41 years ago. And like the signature stopwatch that has opened every hour since the beginning, it's still ticking. In fact, this Sunday's 60 Minutes will be devoted entirely to Don Hewitt. And the problem won't be filling the hour, but narrowing it down to one. On camera, there are two figures in TV news who rise above all others, Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. Murrow invented and set the standards for television news at CBS, and Cronkite exemplified them in the 1960s and beyond. Off camera, Don Hewitt worked with them both. Not only worked with them, but predated them and outlasted them. His career, like his impact on television news, is unparalleled. Start with 60 Minutes, his most enduring legacy. The show has ranked in TV's top 10 in several different decades and has ranked a handful of times as television's most popular show. No other news magazine has achieved a number one ranking for the season even once. And the show's popularity, while definitely skewing older in audience appeal, isn't in the past. Last week's installment, featuring the first post-prison TV interview with Michael Vick, was the week's second most popular program. That's an amazing track record for a show that premiered in 1968. But Don Hewitt, who created 60 Minutes, has a track record that is even more amazing. It took 10 years for 60 Minutes to finish in TV's top 10. And by the time it did, Don Hewitt already had been at CBS News for 30 years. And he'd stay there for another 25 years until he retired from 60 Minutes in 2003. Don Hewitt is like the Forrest Gump or the Zelig of TV news. Whenever something important happened, no matter what year, Hewitt was likely to be there. When CBS began presenting a nightly newscast in 1948 with Douglas Edwards as the anchor, Don Hewitt was an associate director and soon became the program's director. And when Edward R. Murrow made a wary but brilliant transition from radio to television in 1951's landmark CBS news magazine See It Now, Don Hewitt was at his side, literally, as Murrow explained at the start of the very first show.
This is an old team trying to learn a new trade. When we started this series of programs, we had to decide where to do it from. We decided to do it right here from the studio. My purpose will be not to get in your light any more than I can, to lean over the cameraman's shoulder occasionally and say a word which may help to illuminate or explain what is happening. We have here two monitors which will serve in effect the purpose of loudspeakers. They are tied, so to speak, to lines that come in from Chicago, New York, Washington, various other places. We will from time to time show film on those monitors as well. We are, as newcomers to this medium, rather impressed by the whole thing. Impressed, for example, that I can turn to Don Hewitt here and say, Don, will you push a button and bring in the Atlantic Coast?
And at that point, Don Hewitt was just getting started. In 1952, he directed TV coverage of the national political conventions. In 1956, when the luxury liner the Andrea Doria sank at sea and CBS dispatched a helicopter to film the only TV footage of its sinking, Don Hewitt was manning the camera. In 1960, Hewitt was the director for the unprecedented and politically crucial televised presidential campaign debates between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy. In 1963, when Kennedy was assassinated, Hewitt directed the massive nonstop days of coverage for CBS, the coverage that made Walter Cronkite a TV icon. And so on, up to and including Bill and Hillary Clinton's campaign-saving 1992 appearance on 60 Minutes. Arguably, Don Hewitt influenced the elections of JFK in 1960 and Bill Clinton 32 years later. And Hewitt's career didn't end there. But it's not just the durability or the impact that impresses me, though both of those do impress me. More than anything else, what's most incredible about Don Hewitt's accomplishments is the quality. Almost everything he directed, everything he touched, was impressive and presented with a clear respect for the audience. When Walter Cronkite died earlier this summer, many expressed regret that we'll never see his kind again in TV news. Sad to say, but the same thing is true of Don Hewitt.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Here's some news about multitasking. A majority of TV viewers at least sometimes watch the tube and surf the web at the same time. And so, as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the people who make what you watch and what you surf are competing for your eyeballs.
New research shows that over half of TV viewers go online while they're watching TV. That's probably not so surprising at a time when multitasking is a given, but it's a challenge for the folks who want your attention. Mike Vorhaus is president of Magid Advisors that did the study.
People are going back and forth between their email and the TV show. So for the TV advertiser, for the TV programmer, it's all about getting the attention of the consumer back.
Especially young consumers. So a network like MTV had to figure this one out.
Hit up dancecrew.mtv.com for all the info on auditions.
In addition to calling out to viewers to go to their website, MTV uses the lower and upper parts of the screen constantly, inviting viewers to go to MTV.com. Stephen Friedman is MTV's general manager.
I don't think there's a show we do where we're not having our audience go to MTV.com to interact in some kind of way. Because we know they're going to do it anyway.
And for the first time, you can upload a one-minute video of your crew to the website.
Friedman says sometimes viewers who are also online can be the network's biggest boosters without MTV having to do anything.
During our movie awards, we had a situation that got a lot of attention where Sacha Baron Cohen, in his persona as Bruno, dropped into Eminem, the rap singer's lap.
That's a polite way of putting it.
Suddenly, the Twitter world and Facebook and the blogs were going crazy about what had just happened on MTV. And we could see through the Nielsen ratings a massive spike.
Everyone I know is multitasking all the time. I'm multitasking even as we speak.
That's Chuck Porter of Crispin, Porter & Boguski, an ad agency known for luring people online. He says he's seeing TV and online producers try really hard to distract one from the other.
You can have flashing sort of little billboards that come on your online, or you can scream on a TV commercial, and people might fall for it once, but they never fall for it again.
Instead of a shouting match, smart marketers, says Porter, need to engage with the audience. To do that, his agency uses humor and provocation to get people's attention. One of their campaigns for Burger King is like a faux documentary called Whopper Virgins. People in remote parts of far-off countries taste hamburgers for the first time.
Most of them like the Whopper, too.
How does that compare to seal?
But you can't win them all.
Some people were offended by the ad, and that generated buzz. And so people went online to find out more. Chuck Porter says watching TV while surfing online is just one of several reasons it's easier than ever to ignore advertising. All viewers have to do is shift their eyes to engage somewhere else. A few years ago, Crispin, Porter & Boguski did extensive marketing research with the 12 to 15-year-old age group.
And what we learned is they get bored instantly. They get bored even quicker than we thought they got bored. So certainly with this audience, and I believe with all audiences, they get it. You know, they've seen this button, they say, okay, I've seen that. They want something new.
And more they're finding it online. In their research, Magid Associates also found that a third of consumers say short videos online are just as, or more, entertaining as TV. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.